You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Paranormal history has had a long tradition of haunted objects that have caused the owners to be the often unwilling participants in ghostly goings-on. In her new book, Ana Maria Manalos brings us 5 first-hand encounters with some items with some very different hauntings. Haunted Heirlooms features some terrifying encounters with differing entities tethered to possessions that may surprise you. As always, it's a pleasure speaking with Anna, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. But before that, as always, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up for Patreon at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, early releases, and bonus content. A big thank you to Amy, my latest Patreon, and you can also click on the link to sign up in the show notes. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also find our website, mysteriesandmonsters.com, for episodes, information, and merchandise. A big thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. After this conversation, you may become a little more wary of buying anything second-hand, especially if it comes with a free ghost. One of the aspects of the paranormal that often seems overlooked is that regarding the alleged haunted inanimate objects that permeate our world. These days, there seems to be more haunted dolls than you can shake a bunch of sage at, but for centuries, items of furniture have been thought to be cursed or haunted. In her latest book, Haunted Heirlooms, author, researcher, and friend of the show, Ana Maria Manalo, introduces us to 5 unusual items, with a wealth of strange occurrences attached to each of them. Ana, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Paul. Nice to talk to you again.
Oh, always. I can't believe it's been so long. The last time I saw you, I'd not had COVID.
Oh, I hope not.
Yes, and obviously within, you were the first episode of the new year, and everybody was commenting because I had to do my introduction for your episode when you were on at the beginning of this year. I was basically croaking.
Well, you sound much better now.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'm delighted with this new book because there is something about, as I said in my introduction these days, Ana, whenever we talk about haunted inanimate objects, it's always a doll, it seems, most of the time, when people are discussing certain items that are possessed or cursed or haunted or have a strange effect on people. And I'm a lover of history, and I'm also a lover of antiques like yourself. So I'm always interested when I come across stories like this, because there's something deeply personal about these items, because often heirlooms can come from any part of the world. There are a variety of reasons why people may come across them. They may have them passed to them from a relative or a friend. They may find it in a thrift store, a yard sale, an antique shop, even eBay these days. So I think when you come across some strange stories attached to objects that you cover in your books, and there are other famous stories out there that have always deeply interested me, what was it about this particular subject that you thought you wanted to collect these experiences together for your new release?
Well, Paul, I've been toying with this idea for a bit now because this started way back when I was still in university. And I won't date myself, but suffice it to say, I still lived in Connecticut at the time. and back in the day, I used to take the train, and the train was only probably $6 one way to get to New York City. And where we were only about half an hour to New York City. I loved collecting things that were distinctively different. Something that I thought one day might be of value. But most of all, I really just liked things that were well made. Things that were, would you say, had some kind of vintage to it. And because I was poor, you know, being just a simple student, I really couldn't afford them. I really could not, you know, wrap my head around how would I eat the next meal if I bought this expensive object. So I found myself traipsing around what they call flea market or swap meets, as the Californians would term them. And they're usually outdoor types of things where people milled about. There were someone's garbage, but then again, someone else's treasures. So it started for me collecting little porcelain objects, teacups and tea. And you know, Paul, it's incidental that I loved British fine china. So I have so far collected, and I kid you not, probably about 36 teacups. The cups and the saucers that came with them. I have four teapots. Don't ask me to name them. There are so many varied ones. They're numbered, they're marked. You know, if I look at them, I can tell you how old they are and where I bought them. But this started in the 80s. And, you know, at some point I started to graduate to furniture. And, you know, furniture is a lot more expensive.
Yes.
And I found myself in an outdoor flea market with a gentleman friend who happened to have a vehicle, which is rare during that time. So he himself loved looking at old things, and he was driving a vintage Beetle. And not to be confused with Paul McCartney, but the Beetle.
Going to say that. Story would be even stranger.
Yeah, that would be strange. But I fell in love with this wheelchair. It was in perfect condition. It was brocaded in what they call Ashes of Roses, which is a certain patina of pink. And it was just exquisite. So, of course, I thought to myself, well, this is way beyond my means. There's no way. I was working part-time at a mental hospital because I was, you know, majoring in psychology with a major also in bio. But to make a long story short, I was going to walk away from it until I saw a piece of tape attached to the chair. And I couldn't believe it. And I asked the gentleman with the hat, who was sitting there, he was really bored, how much is this thing? And he said, $36. 36. Not 3,600, but so we took it back to my dormitory. And back then, the dormitories were single dormitories. You didn't have a roommate. I was at the very end of the hall, and they were all nondescript. All the furniture was the same, and I thought, oh, this is going to be different. It's going to liven up the room. Yeah. So I plunked it right there, right by the window, and it was wonderful. A few nights later, and I used to just go to the library right after I ate dinner, and then stay there until closing time, because I was very, I guess I was a serious student. I can't believe I was, but I guess I was. I took the last shuttle to the dormitory, which was on the furthest end of campus from everybody else. And lo and behold, the lady who was the room advisor in charge of the floor was standing there, arms were akimbo, and there were two other girls with her, and they were waiting for me. And so I stepped down and I said, what's the matter? And they said, you know, you're supposed to sign in guests when they come in. And the one girl said, I don't think that was a guest that I saw. And apparently, they told me there was a woman that came out of my room, and the woman was wearing flappers, you know, in the 1920s, people wore these. And it was whatever she was doing. She was wearing high heels, flappers, and some kind of a hat. She was dressed to the nines, dressed to go out for the evening. And she just came out of my room. And the one said, is it your sister? I said, I don't have a sister. I don't have a guest. I certainly would have signed them in. And it just went on for until finally it culminated into the most horrifying thing. And I found myself unable to go back to the room to sleep. Took a nasty turn.
When I read this, because obviously this is the first chapter of the book,
mm-hmm.
the thing that strikes me about this first particular aspect of these stories, Anna, is that this one really seems to have been quite, not, I wouldn't say aggressive, but it certainly wasn't shy in not appearing to people. Because when you're reading through your experiences here in the dormitory and what was going on and what was happening with the other people on the floor, how many other people had seen this lady wandering around?
Yeah. And the most haunting part about this is the nun. We didn't want, well, let me explain for the audience. The building itself, the dormitory, was composed of four floors. And it had one wing that was for the women, the students. The other wing was for the nuns. They really didn't have anything to do with the university. They really were just there because it was part of a cloister. And they were renting out from the clergy. We were connected by doors through, it was an L-shaped building, so they could go through if they needed to into our area. But most of all, they shared the parking lot. Some of them would go in and out. And some of them were rather healthy, as you could tell from the one nun who was jogging, unfortunately, late at night.
Mm.
And when you say, yes, this apparition isn't shy, well, I should say really it's a ghost because it interacts with apparitions don't.
Mm.
Yes, it reached out and it hit her. So, and no one to this day can figure out why this being chose her in particular. Not me, and I'm the one that bought the chair, but her in particular. So these things come out of nowhere, and it puzzled me even to this day when I think about it. It sent shivers up my back because there was no signal. There was nothing to tell me when I was touching it, helping to get it into the vehicle. There was nothing strange that I was feeling. And some people used to say to me, you have to really get a feeling of what you're purchasing before you buy it. Didn't you get any kind of, you know what I mean, Paul?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you know, now I do. But I think, you know, when you're 19, 18 years old, you don't really, you know, sense these. At least I did not.
Yeah. I think when we talk about situations like this, it's very easy with the benefit of hindsight, Anna, that if you come across a Queen Anne chair for sale for $36, usually an alarm will go off. But when you, as you say there, you're a 19-year-old lover of antiques, for you, it's the bargain of a lifetime. Why on earth would you possibly think, you know, let's be honest, a haunted chair? Well, I mean, why would there be such a thing? It's nonsense, isn't it?
Yes. And for the most part, you know, I have to tell everybody who's listening, you know, please don't go out there and say every single antique or something that's visiting on it, because for the most part, it's not. It's rare. These events, I think, are rare.
Hmm.
At least for the lifetime that I've had, you know, so far, these four antique dealers don't usually encounter these kinds of things.
Hmm.
But that's what led me ultimately, after going through all these shops in all these states, to put them together, because it's so odd and it's so bizarre.
Was it a deliberate choice to fix the parameters of these encounters and these items, Anna, in the New England area? Or, as you say, is this down to your personal travels that these are people that you have built up a relationship from by visiting their stores and going to these places, and therefore you had first-hand knowledge and a relationship with these people, which made it an easier way to collect these five stories in that aspect?
I think for the most part, these people, because I knew them and they trusted me, and they said that I would keep it confidential, it was easier for them to reveal to me things that they would never share with people who have only been there maybe three or four times. I got to know these people so well. And one in particular, the one in Rhode Island, was the father of one of my classmates. So we go a long way because my classmate is from Rhode Island. That shop has been there forever.
Yeah.
And they've retired now, and he doesn't do that for a living. But because of the time span and the depth of the relationships that I ended up forming with repeat visits, etc., they eventually said to me, just be careful. I remember the one, I called him Sam, and you know which story I'm talking about with the lithograph.
Yes.
Very cautiously, you know, Sam is now out in California with his daughters. But he said to me, be careful. Yeah, I know you still collect, and I know you still love going into all these different odd corners that nobody would go into. Just be more sensitive now. You already know what I'm talking about, because they're hard to disengage. Once they're with you, even after you get rid of the object, you still get that lingering feeling. And I remember that very well, what he cautioned me about. I never seen the lithograph in person, and I'm glad I did not. But I do have the actual photograph of the lithograph. I toyed with the idea of publishing it, including it in the book. I was just one single away from actually sending it to the publisher and saying, go ahead and put it on page, whatever. Because as Sam said to me, it is not something to take lightly when you look at it. Kind of akin to a classic called The Picture of Dorian Gray.
Yes, Oscar Wilde's finest work.
Yes, and this is very much a live print. That's what it is. It's a live print that I believe is driven by the emotion of the person. And I don't know to this day what inhabits it. I'm just glad it's not anywhere near me. I'm glad that in the final analysis, it found a better home.
I think what strikes me about the items that are covered in this book, because as we said at the beginning, there are five particular pieces of furniture. Uh-huh. And I was quite surprised at the variety, because we've got the chair, we've got this terrifying chapter featuring this urn that we'll touch on slightly, because that particular chapter really creeps me out a bit. And we've got the lithograph, we've got a furniture room, and we've got a bookcase. Now, more often than not, whenever we talk about haunted objects in this day and age, especially when we're talking about antiques or items that have been passed down, often it's paintings, or it's a strange statue, or a mirror, often as well, Anna. I know there's one of my favourite alleged haunted object stories that I remember reading about was about a couple in the States in the 90s who bought a bed at a yard sale for their son. I think they were called the Cobbs. And essentially, they basically bought a bed with a free poltergeist. that caused all kinds of problems. And that was one of the first instances I remember as a young man coming across one of these objects. So I was really struck by the variety, because none of the items that are in the book are your typical or cliched even haunted object. When you were speaking with these owners and the people that had to deal with the ramifications of these particular objects and the hauntings attached to them, were you surprised to see such run of the mill, because they're all beautiful items in their own right, but perhaps more unique items that claim to be haunted?
You know, Paul, that's a very interesting question, because I wasn't so much surprised at how they were distinctively different from the run-of-the-mill. I was more surprised about the type of people that arose out of it, the type of hauntings that came out of it, because they were, to me, the common theme of an unexpected death, something with violence. And when I say that, I'm thinking of the haunted furniture room.
Yes.
Which, you know, had an alley in the back, and what happened to the gentleman in that alley. And someone said to me, as I was writing this, it's interesting. And it was actually, it was the husband of Valentina. He had read two drafts of their story, because as I was writing them, I was sending them to the antique dealers to verify if I was on track. They also enjoyed the way I characterized them, because I tried to get as close as possible to the way they actually felt and the way they really were three-dimensionally as people.
Yes.
But I remember the husband was telling me, I could not believe that someone beyond the grave would carry a habit with that. A habit as in someone who loved the drink would still beyond the grave love the drink. And that's what lured them to the objects that was under the window in that furniture room.
Yeah, yeah.
So in answer to your question, it wasn't so much that it was there were objects that weren't usually haunted. It was the kind of hauntings, the kind of people that in life were attached to them. And the theme that came to me was that their lives were cut short.
Do you think as well, because this is often an interesting aspect of this, I know we were joking about when you picked up that chair for the bargain price, and clearly that chair had a reputation even back then, Anna. But often I found that it seems that it depends who buys the item or who takes ownership of it and where they take it. Because often these objects can be passed on. They can be betrothed to people, left to them in wills. As we said, you can stumble across a bargain. There's never usually a sign that says, this item is haunted, beware. I mean, obviously these days there's a few memes and jokes that go around on the internet where people will put signs on chairs and things saying, this chair is definitely not haunted, please buy it, which usually raises a chuckle or two. But often these items have been in shops for years or could have been in homes for years and nothing seems to have happened, or there doesn't seem to be anything that's happened. Do you think sometimes that the object reacts to the person that then takes over it?
It could be. I think when I'm thinking of that question, Paul, I will tell you an instance, and this came to me rather recently, and I think it's apropos to your question. I have a gentleman's friend who lives in Chicago, and he is an avid antique aficionado. And when I say that, he will just simply go to an auction and not think twice about dropping $200,000, perhaps, for a painting. So he is in the company of several other people like himself, and one of them happened to be a very good friend of his. Shortly after this book was published, he picked it up on Amazon. He bought the paperback version and started reading it because he had read the book before, you know, The Way Through the Wood.
Yes.
And because of the history, and now because of, on top of that, the antique part of it, he was really very, very eager to begin reading the book. So in the process of reading the book, because he knew me, he picked up the phone and called and told me the story. He said that one of his best friends had just bought a four-poster bed. It was something he believed was dated in the 16th century. Of course, they had to go through such extent to have it delivered where nothing was scratched or broken. So it cost a fortune in itself to have it shipped. The gentleman, who was the friend, decided he would put it in his bedroom. And then he had someone come in, I think it was the housekeeper, go ahead and change the bedding and, you know, do all kinds of disinfecting And then finally, he retired to bed on his new wonderful four-poster bed. Around 1 a.m., he suddenly woke up after feeling someone whispering in his ear. It was a woman. So he turned, thinking his wife had gotten up and was trying to tell him something.
Mm-hmm.
He opened his eyes, and as she was, he sat up and he said, "What's the matter?" And then she promptly disappeared. He turned around, and there was his wife sleeping next to him on the other side. He shook her awake, and he said, "Did you see that?" And she said, "See what? I'm sleeping." He said, "That was a woman standing." Make a long story short, that bed has been passed through so many people. His wife was sleeping in that bed for several months. He ended up sleeping alone. He never saw anyone or felt anything in that bed. He had to move to the guest room. He loved the bed, but he could not sleep in it for one single night after that night.
My goodness.
So somehow, he was sensitive to whatever it was. He felt a change in their bedroom. Finally, she said to him, "You either come back in here or we're going to have a problem with this marriage." So they sat down and decided, okay, we're going to put the bed out of the room so we can go back to sleep as a couple. They're going to put it in the guest house. They had a guest house. Let's put it in the guest house. And that's where it ended. So my friend in Chicago said, "I'm coming to visit you." And guess where he was going to put him, Paul? He was going to put him in the guest house.
Well, that's one way to test the ghost's frequent visiting, isn't it? And, you know, see how it works. But that, I mean, that's not something, like, as I was saying, there's something about beds. And as we were saying about some of these items, it's very interesting because obviously, as we've mentioned before, Anna, on our previous conversations, you've got a deep love of antiques. And I'm sure I've mentioned this previously when we've been chatting. Where I live here in Sheffield, literally 10-minute walk away is Sheffield's Antiques Quarter. So I can often go for a wander on a weekend and spend a day immersed in beautiful artifacts and objects of all kinds, and a lot of tat as well, let's be honest, of all descriptions and all eras. And there's something for everybody, be it furniture, coins, lighting, modern collectibles, cigarette cards, statues, teacups. I mean, you'd go mental around here, I think, Anna. You'd probably burst your credit card, I think, if you came around here looking for teacups. So when you're looking at this, I find it really odd that beds, more often than not, seem to be one of the most common ones. And so, as you were referring to there, it's intriguing that it only seemed to react or want to be seen by the man rather than his wife.
Yeah, and it's hard. I don't know if it has anything to do with sensitivity, and I'm not suggesting she wasn't sensitive, but I think there's a certain type of person that is more likely to be aware of these types of things. And in this one, it's pretty denying, Paul. It wasn't doing anything to hurt him. It just simply wanted to be seen. It just wanted to be felt. It didn't really disrupt anything, didn't cause any kind of misfortune. But once again, it remained just with him. All the feelings were with him. When he entered the room, he could sense that he was there. She, on the other hand, just went about her business. It was just a beautiful bed, and she was going to sleep on it. Yeah, so I think it really just depends on the person, as you said. It also depends, I think, on the circumstances. I think that when you move something away from routine, as in the case of these objects. People bought them and moved them out of an area or a house. Something is shaken up. Ghosts don't like change.
Mm.
They don't like, as in my next book, they don't like renovation.
Nope.
It scares them up. So move my key.
Yes. Often that's usually a really good way, especially if you're doing renovations. And they often say, if you want to see if your house is haunted, do some redecorating or moving things around and see what happens. So it's very interesting that once again, I suppose it makes sense that if you've got an object that has history and you remove that object from where it's been in situ for decades or even centuries, why wouldn't that have the same effect as renovations?
Yes, yes. I think that any change is frowned upon. Anything out of the ordinary that is not routine. And it you know, you could tell from especially the bookcase, the barrister's bookcase, that was taken out of the mansion.
Mm.
It wasn't even taken out of the state. It was taken out of the mansion just a few miles away and into that particular shop. And then it just stirred it up. And in this case, people were getting sick.
Mm. Have you ever come across an item? I know, as we were saying about this, the Queen Anne's chair that struck you as such a beautiful item. Have you ever, as your investigations and research and your love of the paranormal has developed over the years, Anna, have you now started to look at certain objects in a different way, especially when it comes to antiques? Because personally speaking, it's I can appreciate art in a variety of forms. So if I see a beautiful item, be it jewelry or furniture or decorative artwork, anything like that, I can be struck by a variety of things. I have a real weakness for the Art Deco period, I have to say. But I remember going on holiday a few years ago and we rented a converted church building in the northeast. We were going to a wedding. And it had been done out beautifully. It was fabulous, this renovation. It was an old church barn, I think. And in the dining room, they'd got this absolutely enormous portrait of a woman from sort of the 17th century. And this picture must have been 10 or 12 feet tall. It was massive.
Oh, cool.
And it was, yeah, it was mesmerizing. There was something about it. Now, often people say if they see a picture, oh, it'll creep them out because they say wherever you are in the room, it looks like the picture's looking at you. And this picture had that similar kind of effect on me, but I found myself wanting to spend time next to it in the dining room. So if I wanted to read the paper or a book, rather than sitting in the on a comfortable settee in the lounge, I would be sitting on a chair in the dining room because there was something about this painting that I just couldn't take my eyes off. It was really odd.
So you connected with the painting on a visceral level. You were attracted to the painting.
Mm.
But more importantly, the vibration or the imprint that the painting's owner had left is probably in the same kind of vibration as you're in.
Mm.
Kind of wavelength that attracts you instead of repels you.
Mm. Yeah, and it was quirky as well, because one of the strangest aspects of this portrait that sort of made it jump out at me when I first saw it, other than the fact it was enormous, was the fact that this lady in this beautiful dress, in her left hand, she was holding a rabbit. And that struck me as extremely odd, but also deeply intriguing.
Now, I'm trying to think over time what the rabbit symbolizes.
Mm.
I know it does, and I'm scrappling with it right now, trying to think of what it means, and I know it means birth.
Mm.
And mythically, the rabbit is a very benign creature.
Yes.
It has many predators, but a lamb would be.
Mm.
But it also symbolizes fertility.
Hmm.
This is just off the top of my head. I'm not really sure, but somehow that's what I recall.
Hmm.
So somehow that kind of sense lead me to believe that you were attracted to the benign aspect of the portrait, and perhaps the former owner was someone who was comfortable with you being there as a guest.
Yes. I mean, I've been very fortunate to visit many art galleries. I'm one of those people, probably very similar to yourself, Anna. Whenever I go anywhere, you can usually find me in a museum or an art gallery or rooting around in a castle or an old house somewhere.
Wonderful. Oh, that would be wonderful. If I lived in England, that would be where I would be.
Absolutely. And I've just come back from visiting North Wales for the first time in a very long time. Obviously, had to visit Conwy Castle, which was somewhere I used to go as a child, which was beautiful. But we also visited one of the oldest houses from the Elizabethan period there, which is called Plasmois, which is also supposed to be haunted, though strangely only seems to be haunted in the winter, which is a very strange haunting. I've not come across many like that. And so I'm off. The thing that's always not perplexed me about how I reacted to this particular portrait was that I've seen works of art from some of the most famous artists in the world. I've been very fortunate. I've visited the Picasso Museum in Barcelona. I've seen original Dalis. I've seen Constables, Turners, works of art from some of the greatest artists of all time. And yet, very few of them have had this effect on me that particular portrait by some nondescript portrait artist of the 17th or 18th century had. And it's something that stayed with me a very long time.
So, Paul, can I ask you this? Have you ever thought about looking into who lived there, who the subject was, and the background of the person who painted the painting?
Well, unfortunately, I asked the people who owned the building that we rented, and they said they just bought it from an antique auction. They couldn't tell me anything. They'd bought it secondhand. But it was just stunning. And to the fact that if I was ever fortunate to own a house big enough for a portrait like that, the first thing I would do would be to go out to an auction and find something similar. I doubt I'd ever find that picture. If I was rich enough to buy a big house, I'd probably ask them how much they wanted for that portrait, to be honest. But it stayed with me ever since that I've always been interested in owning something like that, which for a person like myself is completely alien to the concepts of anything else or other pieces of art that I've been attracted to or interested in previously, Anna.
Is it close enough to where you live that you could go back easily?
Well, it's England, so we're not far from anywhere, really. Yeah, it's in the northeast, so it's strangely enough, it's near a very famous location, which also had a very strange incident that happened in the 1970s with a couple of little stone heads that were found called the Hexham Heads, and it's up near that part of England in the northeast.
So the reason why I'm asking is because I'm curious if you took some photographs of the painting, because I'm now really, really intrigued by your story that I'm curious, if you don't mind sending it to me, if you have a photo of it, because I would like to see who, maybe do a little bit of research, who painted it and for what reason. I mean, was she sitting for him, or was it something that he just painted because he met her? And why a rabbit? I mean, most people, I don't know how old the painting was, but most people would pose with a dog, for example.
Yes.
Or a horse. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, obviously. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've definitely got some pictures of it somewhere, so I shall dig them out for you and I will send you them.
Oh, that's wonderful. Because I would like to look into it. I'm curious what made it resonate with you.
Absolutely. Has that ever happened to yourself? Obviously, you are someone that loves visiting these shops and these places where beautiful items are for sale. And have you ever come across something that seems to be strangely magnetic? Because this is often the other thing as well when we talk about haunted objects. Some people will say that they don't understand what attracted them to it, or they don't understand why they bought it. They just thought they had to.
Well, that's an interesting question, Paul, because a lot of times when I go through each shot, I always look at the paintings on the walls first.
Mm.
And then I gravitate to the statues simply because I need some things outdoors for the garden. So I look at things that I can put outdoors. There was one particular statue that lured me, and I don't even know what it's made of, whether it's alabaster. I'm not that familiar with these types of stonework.
Mm.
But the way it was sculpted made me feel that if I had that in my garden, life would be complete.
Mm.
And I stood there. It was, just to give you an idea, it was a French-run shop. And it was huge because it had an atrium, or what they would call, I guess you would call it more a conservatory. It was all glass all around. It had some huge farm tables inside, made of heavy wood. And around these plants that lined this bubble were these statues.
Hmm.
And it was the one statue that I honed in on. It was practically as tall as me. And it was a female figure. And she looked like she had the suggestion of a crown. And she was posed to the side. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, if I could just carry this out to the car, I would die. But I think I'm a woman, and, women shop, not to profile it. As much as I love looking at purses or teacups.
Yep.
I think it was the same kind of, it enamored me because I wanted to own it. I wanted to bring it home and put it in the middle of the garden and have people see it or walk around this and make it kind of like a topic of conversation.
Mm.
But it wasn't really as earth-shattering or as deep as what you're talking about. It wasn't kind of a magnetic as much as just, it was just perfect.
Mm.
For the settings that I was thinking about.
Hmm.
No. So not as profound. Not as profound as yours is what I was going to say.
When you were talking with the contributors to these stories, Anna,
mm-hmm.
often as well, when we talk about strange items or curses even, as we were referring to, and there are many items over the years that have been cursed, some more famous than others. Obviously, there's probably the most famous is Tutankhamun, or the Hope Diamond, I would suspect, are probably the two most famous curses in the 20th century, I would perhaps. But obviously you've got, yeah. I had the good fortune of speaking with Jim Harold recently, ironically, who's done the foreword for your book. And we were talking about James Dean's car, Little Bastard, which was supposed to be a cursed car as well. Because what's happened to that car after James Dean died in it is a whole range of strangeness of its own, which is, it seems very odd that the car's paranormal power seems to have increased after the owner was killed in it.
Well, James Dean, without making a disparaging remark, was very vain in life. This is what I've been told. James Dean was young and he had the whole world in front of him. He commanded a lot of attention, a lot of power because of that. And suddenly it was gone in just one moment.
Mm.
So I would not be surprised that he was holding on to whatever was left of him to be able to remain the owner of that car.
Mm.
And this is what drives my point in the commonalities with these attached objects, that people that own them don't want to let them go. They want to be where they were before in life. They wanted to continue owning the beautiful things they had. And whatever was in their sight in the final moments of their life, it's the one they want to hold on to the most.
Mm.
And in some cases, they're sending out very strong signals, as in the case of the urn. that something was amiss, something was unresolved. They wanted to be found.
Yes.
But for James Dean, I think, and this is just my own personal opinion, he had really wanted to hold on to that vehicle.
Mm.
So anyone who tries to take it from him is doomed.
Well, often as well, when we talk about haunted objects or cursed objects or objects that are associated with a haunting, there is often some kind of traumatic or emotional event surrounding this. So as you're referring to there in regards to Dean and his car, obviously James Dean passed away in this car in the car accident. So it would make sense that there is this kind of emotional entanglement with this inanimate object, which often, when we look into the history of some of these other items of furniture or objects of art that have this reputation of being a haunted object or a cursed object, there is usually something in the backstory or its history that an owner or someone that loved it has passed away through tragic circumstances in a variety of reasons, aren't there?
Yes, much so. Very much so. I would tell you this, Cole. When people pass on and they pass on after a whole entire life, in their old age, there's kind of peacefulness about it. A kind of a letting go and saying, I lived this life, I lived it richly. I had all these possessions and now it's time to move on. But for these people who died young or who died tragically, you don't have that kind of closure. So they vivid. It becomes a struggle for them to find closure. And some of the stories in the book strove to do that for the people who ended up with the object. They looked into the past and tried to do what they could to give it closure.
I think in the collection that you've presented in your latest book, as we were joking before we started our interview and our conversation, Ella, I have to say, the second chapter that features this urn really did send a shiver up my spine.
It did mine too. If I was writing it, I remember I was reading it late into the night. And I remember talking to the daughter and how she spent several nights watching the door, hoping that whatever was out there wasn't back. And I thought to myself, I have to really, because I have a Chinoiserie collection, you know, the blue and white porcelain.
Oh, right.
I have something very similar. She has a more extensive one and more expensive. But mine are mostly ginger jars. But she collects the larger ones, the markets and things of that nature. And I thought to myself, one false step and I don't send the way I should send things to have a discernment, I could end up with something similar. And it's hard to shake them off. If you notice, they're very hard to shake off. You can't quite sell them. You know, I think that that would not be the right thing to do. And you have to lock them and or put them behind glass, as in the case of one of the stories where it was finally put to rest.
Yes. Yes. Or you could just take it to an antique shop and leave it there.
And then the antique dealer would say, oh, what do we have here? I don't remember this as an inventory.
Yeah. It's proactive shoplifting. You're giving things back.
Yes, that would be interesting.
I'm really intrigued by this particular chapter because this seems to be probably the most malicious of the five that you cover. I'm sure different people may think of it in different aspects, but this was the one that I thought there was a real menace and a real fear factor to it attached to this. And it's interesting how the different people who once again witness it all have differing opinions about what it is or what this creature is that they're seeing, because the description seems to sort of be some kind of clawed animal with terrifying eyes. And as we delve into the story, that aspect of it, when we get towards the conclusion of the history of this item, I find it even more perplexing because what they're seeing and what this item is, that for me, there's no kind of folkloric attachment, if that makes sense, Anna.
No, because, you know, for what puzzled me is that without giving it away, it was a victim that needed to be buried.
Mm.
It needed to be discovered. But whatever had attached, and someone told this to me, and I think I mentioned this in a previous show, there was a guardian to the object. And the guardian somehow was protecting this urn.
Mm.
And that's what I believe they saw. They, and you know, the housekeeper was from an old country that had a lot of superstition and folklore. And so her interpretation of it, of course, was more of a demonic, you know, it had that aura of whatever it is needs to be blessed. And she surrounded her bedroom with crosses for that reason. And they were a Catholic family to begin with. So the parents didn't discourage it. The daughter took up residence in the room. Well, you read that. I think because they needed the company of each other as a way to protect themselves from whatever that was.
Yes.
That was ripping at the, and what really surprised me about this one was the immediacy of the reaction, because on the same day that the UPS truck came and delivered it to the front door, within hours, something was attacking the book.
Mm.
Something was trying to rip it open as if it could not breathe. That was the interpretation I had that she first told me, as if it was suffocating and needed to be let out. And unlike the other stories, this creature is unique. The way they were describing it to me, I kept grasping for something in on the internet, in the literature, trying to figure out what the nature of this creature is.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul, I'm still puzzled as you are. I'm perplexed. What is it called? Mm-hmm. Has it ever been seen before?
There's a lot of it that it's almost as if whatever's going on is trying to, when in my personal interpretation of the facts, because the other aspect of this particular chapter is Anna as well. Clearly, these people, if they said this over dinner with friends, or if they'd gone out socializing and they were in a bar somewhere and they were telling people about what they were seeing and what was going on with this urn, with the greatest of respect, most people would laugh at them, I suspect, you know? Or or perhaps tell them that maybe they need to go and see the doctor. And the typical normal response to people who have had a terrifying paranormal experience, because what they're telling us in the reality of the so-called real world is impossible. And yet several people all have different interactions with some kind of terrifying creature that seems to be attached to this urn and is clearly deeply unhappy that this urn is in their possession.
Yes. And even the dog had a reaction to it. And, you know, animals are very sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
So it was one of those things where you wonder, it was so large that it was larger than the dog was a Bernese.
Mm.
And you know how big they are.
Absolutely.
So this is not something you contend with.
Mm.
You don't just shoo it away, because if it's larger than a Bernese, it certainly is going to be very, very intimidating. If it was flesh and blood, which obviously it was not. But I remember the circumstances, now that you mentioned this, surrounding the reason why the couple finally told me that story, because I told them something that was equally implausible.
Yes.
I was actually telling them a story that had more to do with UFOs. And a couple I just had come across in one of my travels in France, was renting, this is totally unrelated, but I'll tell you what brought it on. They were renting a farmhouse in a rather isolated rural area of France as a vacation. And they came upon something very odd in the barn. It had came out as a blue light from nowhere. Mm. And I don't know if you recall reading that story in my very first book.
Yes, absolutely. That's a very creepy story.
Yeah. And so it's in that story, which I did not interpret as being ghosts or a phantom, I interpreted it as an ET. The couple saw something right beneath their window. So it was that kind of an evening when they decided they would tell me the truth about an encounter they had a few years back with an antique, with the urn. And, it frees up people to tell other people that they feel have already told them something that would have been a topic of ridicule.
Were these people still emotionally damaged by what had happened? Because when I'm reading the other stories that you've included in this book, apart from your own, Anna, there's a real emotional resonance in every one of the other four items, that whoever's had this particular piece of furniture or art seems to have had a real emotional change. Because do you think that's because these are people that are used to owning such items or working in such a field that for them, old objects, antiques, they're all the same, aren't they? And yet here they are, they've all ended up with one particular object that's really changed their perception of reality, really.
Yeah, I believe so, because if you read Sam, I called him Sam, that's not really his name, but Sam was very much unhinged by the interaction that he had with the object. It affected, of course, his entire family. He alluded a lot of misfortune that had happened to them since he obtained the object, and of all things, it was given to him by best friend. So I think he felt betrayed by the best friend, who I thought never thought it would come out to that point where he was in jeopardy, where the store was in jeopardy, with a very successful store.
Mm.
But it also led to what had happened to his parents. And that, I don't know to this day if that was just happenstance, that was the last objects that they saw on the wall, or maybe there was something else that was going on. No one will ever know.
Mm-hmm.
But he was extremely emotionally affected by it. And he discontinued after, I would say within 6 months, he really thought about different ways of earning a living because of that.
Which, for somebody who loves the field they work in and what they do and the items they surround themselves in, is monumental.
Yeah, yeah. I think the one that were not as affected, strangely enough, is the one that really sent chills up your spine. Because they're still in business to this day.
They're made of stronger stuff than I am.
They are very tough people, I have to say, very down to earth, wonderful people. But they are very tough. They are very strong in their beliefs.
Mm.
I think it left them kind of scrutinizing things that they come across a lot more closely. They did trim down the inventory considerably for obvious reason. And one of the things I said without really ridiculing her was, you need to open these things when you acquire them. You really must, because you just never, you could also have the opposite. You could open it up and find real euros in there that I don't know, or maybe some precious diamond that you never thought was in it. So, but yeah, it has changed her quite a bit, but probably not as much as you thought it would have. Because they went on from there. And as I said before, these things that happen, they are rare. For the days that I have entered shops, I've never really encountered anything that I would say just kind of like was a red light. Run. I never had that feeling.
Not yet.
Not yet. No. And hopefully never.
Well, it's a fantastic collection and a worthy successor to your previous work, The Way Through the Woods, which was a deeply compelling and confounding collection of experiences from that wonderful lady with such a story to tell. So your next project is taking you in yet another different direction, which is what I always like about your work, Anna. You basically like to just drop surprises on us, because I wasn't expecting this book based on the last one. So what's your next project and where are you taking us this time?
Well, Paul, this one is closer to home. This came my way, and once again, it fell on my lap, as I used to say to people. I hobnobbed Nate in the past year with a bunch of paranormal investigators. I myself, I'm not one. I'm just simply a collector of stories. I put it down as their memoirs. And sometimes, as you see in that last volume, it's an anthology of stories. This particular one is a memoir from an active paranormal investigator. His name is John Curley, and he lived near the area of Harrisburg, and he's very transparent. He said, yes, you could use my name. You can mention my organization. The only thing we don't have permission for is to actually discuss the actual mansion. Mm. So for the sake of the story, we changed the location of the mansion. We changed a little bit about what is surrounding it, because I don't want people flocking there at all hours of the night, because there are new owners in the past year.
Mm.
The book cover, as we speak, is being worked on. It is remarkably similar to the actual mansion, which has two ballrooms, 20 bedrooms, two kitchens. As I recall, it has a beautiful library, a drawing room, and a well-appointed lounge area. Everything, the trappings and all the antiques you ever wanted in furniture are all there. Mm. The difference here, Paul, is that for 5 years, it has passed and it's had five construction crews, and the last three all departed within the year. They could not renovate the house because it is incredibly infested.
Mm-hmm.
So I stepped into this story as the investigator, which it's still an active site, was telling me a narrative that I felt was extremely compelling and unique. A house that was built in the 1750s that was just in opulence, in grandeur, as much as those Newport homes where the antiques were taken from in this book that just got released. This is an opulent home, but it will not be inhabited. It refuses to be renovated. It becomes very active. And so the narrative in this book has to do with the investigation itself as it was unfolding. So you will walk through it, Paul, and you will see what they have seen and experienced what they have experienced in this coming book.
Sounds absolutely thrilling.
Thank you.
And no doubt, Anna, you will have a few scares up your sleeve.
I will have. No, I have not visited it, and I have no plans on visiting it, if that's what you mean. One of the things I do, Paul, is that I do walk into antique shops, but once I hear about these types of stories, I become very cautious. And when it comes to investigating things of that nature, I make sure I have an army with me when I go. And nothing attached, as I think. Unlike this one that's coming up your way, it's that there's tons of attachments.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Well, I can't wait for that one. When's that one due out, my love?
I would think probably the end of October toward November.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. I look forward to that. And is that going to be with Beyond the Fray again?
It is going to be with Beyond the Fray. with Jeff and Shannon. Thank you to both of them. And I'm actually halfway through the manuscript at this point.
Brilliant. Oh, fantastic. Well, I look forward to that. So, Anna, as always, it's an absolute pleasure. Where can everybody get hold of a copy of Haunted Heirlooms and follow your work online?
Okay. I have a website. It's under my name, Anna Maria Elisa, Anna Maria Manalo, author.com. It can also be found on Amazon. Actually, the website has links direct to Amazon. And then the Haunted Heirlooms book, which we discussed on the show, is also now available in Barnes and Noble, which I believe is only in the States.
Oh, fabulous.
Yeah, Amazon is worldwide, so I believe that's probably the fastest way, unless they click on my website, and that's AnnaMariaManaloAuthor.com.
Fabulous. Well, I'll put links, as always, in the show notes for anybody that wants to track both your website and the book down. And I will say, as always, thank you so much for joining me. It's always a pleasure. We always end up chuckling about spooky things.
Yeah.
So, thank you very much, as always. A pleasure to speak with you, Anna.
My pleasure, Paul. Thank you and have a good night.